before you get behind the wheel, silence your phone. Or better yet, designate a texter. For more text-free driving tips, visit stoptextstoprex.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. You are listening to The Big Picture. I am Chase Blaine, and with me as always is Derek Gary. We're going to be here with you till 9 o'clock. If you want to give us a call at 855-915-WMFO. And now is one of our favorite segments of the program, which is called Did You Hear? Where we test each other on the various news segments from the last week. For me, I'm going to start off with Julian Edelman.
Julian Edelman may have stopped a school shooting in Michigan.
As if there wasn't everything he could already do.
By noticing a response to an Instagram post.
Yes.
So, good for him.
He received a message from a follower saying that someone had posted a threatening comment and asked his assistant to check his Instagram to find out what it referred to. And the comment said, "I'm going to shoot up my school. Watch the news." And Edelman asked her to call 911. They ended up getting the IP address of the boy who posted the threat. They say the police visited a house. He admitted posting it. There were two guns in the home, which belonged to his mother. And the boy is now being held in a juvenile detention center and was charged with making a false report of a threat of terrorism, which is a felony punishable by up to 4 years.
We will keep the celebrity theme going. Or no, the sports theme going.
Sports theme going.
New York Yankees.
New York Yankees. You know that that's like a swear in my household.
Yes,
there.
I know.
I don't know.
Canceled opening day because of snow.
Oh, well, I mean, I guess I knew that.
Snow. They were supposed to open on Monday. Snow.
Oh, poor pinstripes.
Tell me this baseball season isn't too damn long.
Those poor pinstripes jerks. Citizenship.
It's
census.
Oh, the census. Repeating something that was done during the Clinton administration to no fanfare or consternation whatsoever, not a single peep about it, the Trump administration has announced that the upcoming census will include a question about whether or not people in the household are United States citizens. Everyone has been out of shape because, oh my God, this has never been done before, which is not true. That is a bald-faced lie.
It's not a matter of it not being done before. It's a matter of the context in which it's done.
You know, I sit here all the time and say, be wary of people who make lists. And when Bill Clinton is in the White House and wants to make a list of all the illegals, everybody's fine with it. Donald Trump's in the White House and wants to make a list of all the illegals, it's the end of the world.
But it's a matter of the difference between what each of them are going to do with that information.
There is no difference. You do not want the list to exist in the first place. So either we make this question legal and we have it all the time, or we make this question illegal and we never ask it, one or the other. But don't give me this hypocrisy about,
but
oh my God.
It's a matter of that it was added in the context of the other various citizenship arguments.
Obama dropped it from the census. Clinton had it. Bush had it. Now Trump is putting it back in.
Well, Obama dropped it for the exact reasons, or I'm sorry, the exact opposite reasons that Trump put it back in. That's the point, is that it's not a matter of, it's a matter of that it wasn't a threatening question beforehand.
It's not a threatening question now.
Really?
Yeah.
He's trying to get rid of DACA. He's trying to build a wall.
He has said time and time again that he supports DACA. He is not trying to get rid of DACA. Okay? Congress did absolutely nothing.
He's trying to abridge DACA. He is trying
to formalize the status of people who are under DACA right now, and to say, yes, you are full. He's trying to get them citizenship, and he's been trying to get them citizenship since he took office, and he's said that repeatedly.
No, he's not trying to get them citizenship. He's trying to see if they qualify for it, and if they don't, he's making them leave.
He's trying to get them citizenship.
Oh, we have already spent way too much time on this topic.
That has always been the subtext of that.
Stephen Bochco. I don't know.
You know who Stephen Bochco is?
I don't know what the story in reference is.
But you know who Stephen Bochco is?
I believe so.
The creator of Hill Street Blues, Los Angeles Law, LA Law, NYPD Blue.
Oh, that guy.
And yes, Cop Rock. Passed away on Sunday at the age of 74. Bochco had been fighting leukemia for the last 4 years.
Oh, if it had been a sexual harassment suit, I would have known him.
No. One of the most influential television producers. A lot of what you see on television today traces its roots back to stuff that Stephen Bochco was doing in the 1980s. Hill Street Blues remains a landmark television series and absolutely worth watching. It still stands up today in a way that a lot of television from the 80s and 90s doesn't.
Oh, spoken like a true Generation X. Dunkin' Donuts.
Dunkin' Donuts. What did I see about them? They're not buying Tim Hortons. Dunkin' Donuts, they're buying somebody. No?
Mm-mm.
Is this about the Girl Scout donuts?
No, it's more current.
Is there a new donut flavor I haven't tried? There is.
Well,
it's April.
Sort of. Well, they're testing a new $2 snacking menu at a small number of restaurants in the Boston area just to kind of test it out and see how people like it.
Do I get donuts?
Well, actually, they will include Munchkin Bites, which will be a 4-pack.
Like them.
Donut Fries.
Nope.
Pretzel Bites, Ham and Cheese Roll-Ups, and my most terrifying reaction is to the Waffle Breaded Chicken Tenders.
These are bad ideas.
This is such a bad idea.
Bring back the chocolate-filled donut globally at all your locations, and let's just keep it to the donuts.
Couldn't we just stick with... I remember when they started adding, like, normal food. And I understand marketing-wise, a lot of times the only thing in the area is Dunkin' Donuts. And you're like, I don't really want, like, a donut or a bagel. I want something else. But their regular food is so disgusting.
Those mint.
I gave it a chance.
Those mint brownie batter donuts they had last month. Oh my God, so good. Robert Mueller.
Oh, the first person to have to serve prison time has been charged. Actually, this is going to be Alex Vanderzwan. And he pled guilty in February to making false statements. And when he was interviewed last...
I think it was false statement, singular, but they call it false statements. He made one.
Yeah, one false statement when he was interviewed last fall about his phone calls and emails with a former Trump campaign aide, Richard Gates. He's going to serve 30 days in prison, but this is expected to be the first of multiple sentences. I'm saying first of multiple sentences in this investigation.
Now, folks, call up your congressman and ask how many millions of dollars we spent to send a guy away for 30 days for making a false statement to the FBI. I will take that as an answer. The other one that I was looking for is the Washington Post reported yesterday that Robert Mueller says President Trump is not a target of his investigation.
That's the cutest statement I've ever heard.
President Trump is not. No, this is straight out of Robert Mueller's mouth. People connected to the investigation have said, told the Washington Post, that President Trump is not a target of the investigation. He is a subject of the investigation. What is the difference? As a subject, there is no presumption of any criminal wrongdoing on President Trump's part. I told you a year ago this was going to spend a lot of money, send a few people to jail for some completely unrelated offenses, and turn up nothing connecting the Trump campaign to Russia. The Washington Post basically has that coming out of Robert Mueller's mouth. So stay tuned and enjoy the millions of dollars that were spent to catch a couple of people fibbing to the feds.
What a country. Spotify.
Spotify had not an initial public offering, but a direct stock listing yesterday.
The largest ever.
That valued them at, I believe, $39 billion.
Yep.
And it's interesting.
It was at closing, the initial, or before closing, the initial projection was 30, but by the end of the day, it was 39.
Usually, new companies go the IPO route, which means that you hire a bank to bring you to the market, and then the bank gets a big chunk of whatever your valuation is. Spotify said, "Nope, we're just going to a straight listing," and so they get to keep the $39 billion. And apparently, they're going to throw a lot of that back to their people. So,
which I mean, good on them, I guess.
If you own a Lexus dealership near Spotify headquarters, order extra this month. The folks are coming in.
It did anger a lot of people in the New York Stock Exchange, though, because mainly just because they were like, this isn't how we do things, Spotify.
Yeah, well, because they want to get in for cheap and then bleed everybody else dry while they take the money.
Which is why I thought it was kind of funny that Spotify went, nah, 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 nah.
Yeah.
We're too big to touch.
I like what Spotify did. Nice move. Rift.
Rift.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. No.
This story was a little bit off the beaten path. A 50-mile rift appeared in Kenya, west of Nairobi, and took out a major highway this week.
Oh, yes.
The crack, which is up to 65 feet wide,
international news.
Which is up to 65 feet wide in places, has likely, according to scientists, always been there, but it was full of volcanic ash. So recent heavy rains in March.
That's not unsettling at all.
Washed away the ash, and boom, here's your crack again. So this is part of the Great Rift Valley, this area where this took place, which is an area where Africa is literally tearing itself apart into two different land masses due to the movement of tectonic plates well below the surface.
So it's just like the plot of, what was that show with Jessica Alba? Dark Angel. Where Los Angeles just became an island because the rifts finally...
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad I don't...
20 million odd years was going to be some brand new beachfront property in Africa. So...
So start laying your bids, Hollywood.
Yeah. Invest now, kids.
China movies.
China movies. I haven't seen anything about China.
This was shocking to me, to be honest with you. China's theatrical box office overtook North America to become the biggest in the world in the first quarter of this year.
Oh, interesting.
Which hasn't happened pretty much since movies became a thing.
Even with, like, Black Panther making all that money?
Gross theatrical revenues in China amounted to 20.2 billion yuan, which is also known as renminbi, in the 3 months to the end of March. And using a conservative exchange rate to the U.S. dollar, that equates to $3.17 billion. In comparison, North American theaters, comprising those in the U.S. and Canada, enjoyed aggregate revenues of $2.8 billion in the same period.
It was a turkey of a quarter for Hollywood, by the way, other than Black Panther.
Yeah. Black Panther is the only reason that that number is that high.
Everything else tanked. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, people...
But, like, this is, I always think of that, there's a joke by John Oliver, where he opens one of his specials with it, saying, if you're not understanding this accent, I can't do a British accent, but he has a British accent, and he says, if you're not understanding this accent, it's British, and you all could have had this, and that's the pity. But you all got mad at us for colonization, but you're all doing it too. It's like you're running with you took the baton from us, and you're just running towards China to bring us to the finish line. And that's, I mean, I always thought that was like, that's a funny joke, but this makes me, oh, goodness.
I loathe him.
What's happening? You loathe John Oliver?
I loathe him, yeah. I love it. Certain British personalities wind up in the United States because they hate them that much over there. Russell Brand is a good example of this.
Oh, see, I hate Russell Brand.
John Oliver is a good example of this.
I love John Oliver.
What's his face that does the other talk show? The car karaoke guy. I can't remember his name right now.
Oh, that guy's annoying. Blonde hair.
Yeah.
He's gay. He does the...
He's a great singer.
He does, like, he has celebrities in his car. I know who you're talking about. Yeah. He's annoying, yeah.
But they love him over there. Like, he's very popular over there, but he realized he could make more money over here. So he's not a refugee slumming it in the States.
Oh, God, we're doing this again.
Yeah.
All right, last one on you.
Kratom. Kratom, crouton, kratom, kratom.
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 The FDA ordered a mandatory, really, Shay? God, I can't work on
See, at least I'm just mispronouncing kratom wrong.
Mandatory. I've been working all day. No more work on Wednesdays, Caitlin. A mandatory recall yesterday of kratom. Because it may be contaminated with salmonella. I guess it's kind of unfortunate because it's supposed to be used to treat pain and also help people. It's supposed to be a better alternative to the other thing that gets people off of
opium.
Heroin.
Well, the people who use it say it feels like heroin.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
And that's caught the attention of the federal government.
Well, it's supposed to make people stop using opioids and help them. Well, ironically, depending on, it's similar to the effects of antidepressants on certain people, is for some people it feels like opium or it feels like heroin. For other people, it feels like a stimulant where they get like really hyper and, oh my God, I could work for 8 hours.
But more specifically, and this, because there is this whole, like, it's a light opiate effect kind of thing, and we don't know that we want that. There is a salmonella outbreak linked to kratom. Kratom. I get kratom?
Kratom.
Kratom, whatever. With it. Salmonella outbreak.
It's Kratom.
Yeah, I think it's kratom. There is a salmonella outbreak linked to it. Now, what's interesting about what the FDA did is this is the first mandatory recall in FDA history.
Yes.
They've never issued a mandatory recall before. Why? Because usually when the FDA sends out a letter saying, please recall your product, the company that makes the product complies. Not so Las Vegas-based Triangle Pharmaceuticals, which said, no, we're not going to pay any attention. They didn't even respond. They're getting letters from the FDA. I don't know if nobody's in the office.
Yeah. I was going to say, and they sent just warnings against, as you said, they sent warnings against its use just based on, like you said, people are like, oh, this is kind of like opium.
Yeah.
But then they issued a large voluntary recall after 87 people got sick.
Yeah.
So, it is interesting because the FDA was actually widely criticized for having never just force a company to get rid of something, given the disgustingness that does exist in our world.
Here's what you don't want to be taken.
It kind of tells you.
Yeah, here's what you don't.
How bad this must be.
Here's what you don't want to be taking, kids. Raw Form Organics Mind Day Kratom, Emerald Green. Raw Form Organics Mind Day Kratom, Ivory White.
Totally sounds like just street drugs.
And Raw Form Organics Mind Dye Kratom Ruby Red. So that is the Emerald Green, Ruby Red, and Ivory White Mang Day Kratom. Those aren't Pokemon games.
The Sour Diesel, the Sensimilla.
Yeah. If it's in your house, don't take it. It may have the salmonella in it. Please send it to the Food and Drug Administration. No, throw it out and don't use it. 855-915-9636 is the telephone number. It is The Big Picture. She is Shay Spillane. I am Derek Gary. When we come back, we will note today's importance in history and the legacy of one of the most important figures of the 20th century. Ahead of that, one of my favorite spring songs from one of the greatest singing voices of the 20th century.
Old people talk to themselves when they sit all around all day. This old woman I knew, I used to go over there, sit with her, and she'd be sitting around in a rocking chair talking to herself, and she used to say, sometimes the cold gets in my bones so bad till I just don't think I can go on. Yeah, and for a little while, well, I don't care if my days are coming to an end, I'd just as soon be gone sometimes. Sometimes the night comes down on me and I know what's ahead. An evening in this cold old house with no one to say goodnight to me when I go to bed. An evening in this cold old house with no one to say goodnight to me when I go to bed. Sometimes I wonder why I stay, what am I waiting for? My children are grown and gone away, they got children of their own now, don't need me anymore. Winter, when the streets are bare, there are nothing much to see. I just can't help missing and thinking about that kindly man that one old winter time came and took away from me. And then one morning, another spring is there outside my door. Things are blooming, birds are singing, and suddenly, yes, well, I ain't sad. Restored. I've had my love, I've had my children, and I have so many memories. So don't mind me complaining what the years may bring, 'cause this old world has been fine with me, really. And I'm thankful for seeing another spring. It's gonna be better this time. Another spring. It's gonna be groovier this time. Another spring. It's what's happening this time. So I'm thankful for letting me see another spring.
Hi, this is James Brown, Soul Brother number one. Always fighting. Now I'm fighting for your life. I'm fighting for your life because if you use drugs, you better leave it alone. Drugs are contagious. They're killers. Every drug is a killer. Stay away from drugs. Drugs will take your life away. And if you want to live, stay away from drugs. Because they are super bad, super bad, super bad, super bad, super bad, super bad.
Baby, you can drive my car. Hey everybody, Jamie Lee Curtis here for RAD, recording artists, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. What should you do to stop a friend from driving if they've been drinking? Answer, whatever it takes. Think before you drink. Designate before you celebrate. Choose a designated driver. Remember, friends don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. It is The Big Picture. Derek Gary and Shea Spillane with you until 9 o'clock tonight, when On the Town with Mikey D will be here with everything you need to know about the Boston music scene. 855-915-9636 is the telephone number. 855-915-WMFO. It is a significant day in the history of our country.
It is indeed.
50 years and less than 2 hours ago today, Dr. Martin Luther King was shot and killed as he stood on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. King had traveled to Tennessee to support striking sanitation workers and checked into his favorite room, number 306, which he had occupied so many times that it had come to be known as the King Abernathy Suite, Abernathy being Reverend Ralph Abernathy, a fellow light in the civil rights movement. Dr. King's death at the age of 39 sent a dagger through the heart of America's innocence and triggered riots in more than 100 cities. The anger that lingered among a great many Americans of all races would light the fire beneath the protest movements of the 1970s and facilitate the rise of the Black Panthers and the Nation of Islam. That anger lingered through the decades, influencing director Spike Lee, the Los Angeles riots of 1991, and the protests that shook Baltimore and Ferguson, Missouri. On the night before his death, Dr. King spoke to the striking sanitation workers. Known as the "I've been to the mountaintop" speech, it is not as well known as his "I Have a Dream" speech, but it is no less powerful nor prophetic. We bring a portion of that speech to you now, put together from video clips captured by different people, so there will be some minor audio issues with it, so that we might remember a moment when a pure and hopeful voice called on us to come together, to do better by one another, and to stand in defiance of those who would intimidate us into accepting oppression.
People of Memphis, to be fair and honest in its dealings with its public servants who happen to be sanitation workers. Now we've got to keep attention on that. That's always the problem with a little violence. You know what happened the other day, and the press dealt only with the window breaking. I read the article. They very seldom got around to mentioning the fact that 1,300 sanitation workers are on strike and that Memphis is not being fair to them and that Mayor Loeb is in dire need of a doctor. They didn't get around. We're going to march again, and we've got to march again in order to put the issue where it is supposed to be. And force everybody to see that there are 1,300 of God's children here suffering. Sometimes gone hungry, going through dark and dreary nights, wondering how this thing is going to come out. That's the issue. We aren't going to let any may stop us. We are masters in our nonviolent movement in disarming police forces. They don't know what to do. I've seen them so often. I remember in Birmingham, Alabama, when we were in that majestic struggle there. We would move out of the 16th Street Baptist Church day after day. By the hundreds, we would move out, and Bill Connor would tell them to send the dogs for. And they did come. But we just went before the dogs singing, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." We're going on. We need all of you. This is what we have to do. Now, the other thing we'll have to do is this. Always anchor our external direct action with the power of economic withdrawal. Now, we are poor people. Individually, we are poor when you compare with white society in America. We are poor. Never stop to get that collectively, that means all of us together, collectively we are richer than all the nations in the world with the exception of nine. We don't have to argue with anybody. We don't have to curse and go around acting bad with our words. We don't need any bricks and bottles. We don't need any Molotov cocktails. We just need to go around to these stores and to these massive industries in our country and say, "God sent us by here to say to you that you're not treating his children right. And we come by here to ask you to make the first item on your agenda fair treatment where God's children are concerned. Now, if you're not prepared to do that, we do have an agenda that we must follow. And our agenda calls for withdrawing economic support from you. So as a result of this, we're asking you tonight to go out and tell your neighbors not to buy Coca-Cola in Memphis. Go by and tell them not to buy Zill Test Milk. Tell them not to buy, what is all the bread, Wonder Bread. And what is all the bread from the Jesse? Tell them not to buy hard bread. As Jesse Jackson has said, up to now, only the garbage men have been feeling pain. Now we must kind of redistribute the pain. We are choosing these companies because they have been fair in their hiring policies. And we are choosing them because they can begin the process of saying they are going to support the needs and the rights of these men who are on strike. And then they can move on town, downtown, and tell Mayor Loeb to do what is right. Some practical things that we can do. We begin the process of building a great economic base, and at the same time, we are putting pressure where it really hurts. And I ask you to follow through here. Now let me say, as I move to my conclusion, that we've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We've got to see it through. Let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. That's the question before you tonight.
Yes.
Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers. What will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers. What will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question.
You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. And while sitting there autographing books, a demented black woman came up. The only question I heard from her was, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And I was looking down writing and I said, "Yes." And the next minute I felt something beating on my chest. Before I knew it, I had been stabbed by this demented woman. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. And that blade had gone through, and the x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you're drowned in your own blood. That's the end of you. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. I want to say tonight, I'm happy that I didn't sneeze, because if I had sneezed,
all right,
I wouldn't have been around here in 1960 when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962 when Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. The black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama, to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully,
And we've had the plane protected and guarded all night. And I got into Memphis. And some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. Tonight, I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., April 3rd, 1968, Memphis, Tennessee, less than 24 hours before his death. A speech that is considered prophetic in a number of corners. Two things that really stick out to me in that speech and in the legacy of Dr. King. Early on, and this actually, this is the last 15 or so minutes of a 45-minute speech that he gave. But early on in what we heard tonight, he talks about how violence fails. And he talks about how there was a march in Memphis, Tennessee, where some windows had been broken. And instead of focusing on the cause, instead of focusing on the people, the only thing the news media was interested in was the broken windows. And we still see this today.
Yeah.
We talk more about Antifa and we talk more about disruption and violence at protests than about the cause of protests. Although we've gotten a little bit better about it. Ferguson, I think, as much as it was there in front of you, hour by hour on the television, it was accompanied by this constant question of why. And the media had to fill in the why and did a fairly good job of getting that part of it across at the same time that we were watching
extraordinary acts of violence.
Yeah, watching a big chunk of town burn to the ground. The other thing that really sticks out for me is his talk about boycotts, because boycotts were one of the most effective tools that the civil rights movement had. And he raises the point that we're poor. Speaking to the sanitation workers, speaking to the black Americans that he fought so tirelessly for. Individually, we are poor, but collectively, we are richer than all but nine nations on earth. And he understands if you leverage that economic power, you bring about change. It is an idea that has come and gone and sort of come back again in the internet age, only instead of the boycott, now we have the social media shaming of whoever the bad guy of the moment is.
Which I feel like somewhere in the middle is the better thing to land on. Because it's, I think that, to be honest, and I mean, I don't know if this is correct, but I think the boycott that gets internet fame is a better avenue than a bunch of people saying terrible things about somebody on the internet.
The interesting thing is, the most effective boycott that I can think of in recent memory came when Bank of America said that they were going to start adding additional fees for people who used their ATM cards. a very large number of Americans, myself included, have Bank of America ATM cards.
Yes.
So obviously I have a vested interest in following this story. Over the course of one weekend, 5% of Bank of America customers said they were going to cancel.
Yeah.
They were going to walk away. They were essentially boycotting Bank of America. And they reversed course. And they said, okay, we're not doing the fees.
I would say, well, that's just what I mean. An actual boycott, like an actual active to the source boycott that gets publicity is more effective than just a bunch of people being like, this guy's a jerk. This was, I've never actually been, as he was saying it, I was reading the transcription. Very moving speech, obviously, especially knowing that he passed, you know, he didn't pass 24, he got shot less than 24 hours from then. But on the smaller scale, I really like the aspect of him talking about getting stabbed early on in his activism and, the whole, first of all, it's adorable to just repeatedly talk about had you sneezed. but it also, I think it drives home how even though he was such a large influence, obviously, I mean, it's not even 50 years since he started his activism, started becoming an incredibly famous man. It's 50 years since he passed away. And we still talk about him. We have a day of the year to think about it. And the sheer fact that he thinks about something on such a small scale as, not even a small scale, that's the wrong way to put it, but it puts everything to perspective for yourself, him putting it that way, because, yeah, he was already a great man in when this happened, which he's saying this happened in 1960, or just before 1960. And all the things that he mentions that happened to him in the, it turned out to be 8 years left that he had alive, and the things that he got to be involved in, the things he got to witness, the things he got to help happen. It really makes you think about the, I know this sounds cheesy, but the fact of how, first of all, how precious life is, which is the cheesy part of this, but secondly, how much things can change in just a moment, and how much one can accomplish. He was 39.
Yeah.
He was 39. Like, that's never even registered to me until this moment. He was 39 years old,
You think of him as being this towering figure that stretches across generations.
I think of him like he's in his 60s. I think, you know, I think of him as someone who, it must be so much older and wiser. Well, definitely wiser, but who must be so much older and wiser as a result of being older. And here was this person who, I mean, he really started his career. He truly started his career in earnest in activism when he was 27, 28 years old. And for one of the most noble causes there can be. And my other point is that it does, I still get sick to my stomach having to think about that. This, obviously, as a result of him, so many strides have been made, but this is still happening. Like, this is still on a smaller scale for the most part, but this is still an issue in our country. This is still an issue 50 years after this man was assassinated, fighting his butt off to make it stop. And again, I mean, yeah, we technically don't have segregation anymore. We don't have,
we don't have legal segregation.
What I'm saying. We legally don't have segregation anymore. There are several parts of the country that theoretically have tried to eradicate overall racism. But that's the thing, is like, I can't even say it in any definite terms, because even when I've lived in the most liberal parts of the country, it's been there. And I know that's me speaking as a white woman, but that's not me being like, oh my God, it's happened to me, because obviously it hasn't. I've had sexism performed against me, but definitely not racism. But I've witnessed it, and even in the most subtle of ways, it's like, it's insane that we're still dealing with it, It's remarkable to think about the fact that we're still dealing with it on this. I'm not diminishing how much racism is out there right now, but I'm saying compared to this, it is a way smaller scale. And the fact that when it was as even more in the entire country, even more loud and terrifying and violent and volatile, that he would just stand up and talk about this in front of thousands of people. And that he knew, as you said, Derek, it's similar to at the end of Tupac's rap career. I don't know if you know this. He made like 100 songs in like 6 months. He just kept recording track after track after track. And everyone's like, why are you working so hard? He's like, I don't know. I just feel like I'm going to die. And it was almost like he knew. He was like, I have to get all this work done as soon as possible because I feel like I'm going to die.
Well, in Dr. King's case, a lot of people had been killed over the course of the Civil Rights Movement.
Well, yes, I know that. But
by virtue of putting your head up over the parapet, you were asking for and inviting that kind of violence in your life.
Oh, I'm not trying to say that Tupac is Dr. King. Just saying.
Yeah, there is that
sense of it's almost like he was working so hard because he, and he was, he was a very intuitive man, let's put it that way. He was a very intuitive man. And not saying he was having a premonition the night that he said this speech, but at the same time, it was very indicative because, like you said, there have been threats. Everyone who tossed their hat in that ring had threats against them. But it's amazing that given that premonition, given that feeling of that he had a mark on his head, that he still said, no, I'm going to stand up in front of all these people and I'm going to say all of this.
And that in itself is a powerful act.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of things about Dr. King and his entire movement that were very powerful. One of them is that Dr. King did not demonize groups of people. He was, in a very real sense, the conscience of the nation. And he approached his movement in the language of religion, which was widely understood on the same terms by both blacks and whites. So if you walked to a group of white people and said, why are you treating God's children this way? It was a phrase that he used often. He was basically saying, you and I have read the same Bible. You know that you are not living by those laws that you claim to follow, and we are asking you why. Not because you were a bad person, not because white people are bad. He did not hesitate to isolate and identify individuals who he saw as problems, particularly political leaders, particularly corporate leaders, who did not support the civil rights cause. But Martin Luther King did not blame white people.
Yeah.
There is no speech of Dr. Martin Luther King where he comes out and says, all white people are bad. Shoot the whites. I hate the whites. The whites are awful.
Well, I wish I could find this in the transcript, but I apologize if I don't quote it properly. But there is one point in the speech that he says, our confused white brothers, or something to that effect. He never says those white jerks or those white. It's always our confused white brothers. He always made a point to make it to try to drive forth the fact that we're all just human beings, that we're all in this together. It's just that these ones are confused. These ones don't know what they're doing. These ones aren't getting it right, but they will, hopefully. Like, it was always framed in that sense, instead of, which I think gets lost a lot of times in the, because I've seen so many people just try to say, like, white people are the worst or black people are something. Neither of those are going to help us at all. Like, neither of those opinions, no opinion like that is going to help us. The best opinion to help us is exactly what he was trying to put forth, which was, you're exactly right. We're all just people. Some people are just confused. Some people just don't understand. Some people just need help to understand. It shouldn't be a matter of this color, this sex, this sex, this fill in the blank. It should be a matter of just, I mean, that's what's so frustrating about the fact that he was assassinated, is that you have to stop and think. And of course, I mean, it's conjecture and trying to figure out what might have been is neither here nor there, but you have to stop to think, had he not been assassinated, where might we be now?
I think the most important takeaway is that he did not divide. He united. That was his message. Bring people together and we will achieve change. And in this day and age, that is a message that we could all stand to heed and remember. 855-915-9636 is the telephone number. It is WMFO Medford. Shea Spillane, Derek Gary with you until 9 o'clock. And then On the Town with Mikey D will be here with everything you need to know about the Boston music scene. When we come back, the strangest things from the past week and our favorite things from the past week here on WMFO Medford.
Okay, gang. So, chances are there'll never be an emergency ever again.
Mm-hmm.
But, just in case, let's talk about a plan.
Okay.
So, who's gonna do what? Anyone? Yeah, okay, perfect. We'll figure it out as we go. So, who is going to grab the go bag?
What's a go bag?
It is a bag we do not have that is filled with things we really, really need in an emergency.
Guess we won't have to worry about it then.
Ah, good point. So, we all know who to call if something happens then, right?
I'd have to call Jill, Devin, Melissa, Karen, and Bruce.
And I will try to call all of you, but Greg doesn't have a cell phone. Dad's phone will have a dead battery.
No doubt.
And Julie will be on the phone with Jill, Devin, Melissa, Karen, and Bruce.
Well, this is great. I am so glad that we don't have a plan.
I know.
Winging It is not an emergency plan. Make sure your kids know what to do during an emergency, who to call, where to meet, what to pack. Visit ready.gov/kids for tips and information. A public service announcement brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Everything is awesome. Everything is cool when you're part of a team. Everything is awesome when we live in our dream.
WMFO Medford 91.5. You are listening to The Big Picture. We're wrapping things up here with two of our favorite segments. First of all is What's Hot, which is what we think is the hottest thing that happened in the last week, or the coolest, the however you want to put it. For me, it's that researchers, so excited, announced on Monday that making medical marijuana available might help reduce opioid prescriptions. They found states that legalized the medical use of marijuana saw small reductions in opioid prescriptions for Medicare and Medicaid patients. These prescriptions are usually considered to be the major driver of the opioid abuse epidemic, and medical marijuana laws could be a part of the solution. This report was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's JAMA and Terminal Medicine, where they wrote that based on their findings, marijuana is one of the potential non-opioid alternatives that can relieve pain at a relatively lower risk of addiction and virtually no risk of overdose. Win for the green team.
And we're going to have legal recreational marijuana here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts before too long.
I know. So, and that's why, I mean, everyone hop on our bandwagon, yo. That's the thing is, that's why I want to include this, is I feel like a week doesn't go by that there isn't another medical researcher from an actual, this is the AMA, this is an actual accredited medical organization,
yeah,
being like, oh, those hippies have been right this whole time.
Hey, no, it's okay. Well, I just stumbled across this, as apparently so did a lot of other people. There is a hot new craze sweeping Japan, particularly kids on the internet.
No, not this.
It does not involve eating soap. It does not involve snorting condoms through
your nose.
Okay,
I was afraid
nose.
It was going to be that.
What they are doing is they are taking aluminum foil and they are making balls out of it. They are then hammering, sanding, and polishing these balls to a mirror surface. It takes hours and a tremendous amount of tenacity and patience to do this. And the end result,
why are they doing that?
Is beautiful. Because it's something to do. The challenge is to see who can make the
shiniest,
roundest, most perfect ball out of aluminum foil. And when you look at the finished results,
I hate that me and my friends are going to get stoned in a couple days and do this.
There's videos online that you can watch of people doing it.
I'm not going to snort a condom, but I'll do that.
There's videos you can watch online of people doing it. What you need, if you want to do it yourself, is aluminum foil, which you have in your house somewhere, a hammer, which you probably have in your house somewhere, because you make the ball and then you hammer it down to fully compress it so that you've got a nice solid surface to work from. Then you're going to need a couple of different grits of sandpaper and some metal polish, and you just keep working it and working it.
Is it weird that I have metal polish?
And you will eventually get to a completely smooth surface.
I'm not lying. Like, this sounds like something both my roommates, Capricia, Ethan, we're doing this the next night.
There are videos online on YouTube if you want to see it for yourself. Pretty cool. Here's an internet fad that we can actually endorse and get behind for a change.
WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. You're listening to The Big Picture. We're going to finish things off tonight with one of our favorite things, which is That's a Thing That Happened, one of the craziest stories from last week. I couldn't believe that this is a thing that can happen. It tells you how slow the wheels of government work in some countries. Not really, but that's awesome in our own. But a man named